This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll hear from Congressman Steve Scalise. He's been on Capitol Hill for 5 years, and this is an interesting time for the Republicans in the U.S. House of Representatives as we ramp up for an election year next year. Also, Obamacare is on the front burner. Other issues such as immigration, we'll discuss it all with Steve Scalise. And it was 8 years ago this week that Hurricane Katrina came calling in Louisiana. I'm sure Congressman Scalise remembers that as vividly as we do. Also on the show in the latter half of the program, we'll hear from Cody Worsham, the editor of Tiger Rag, about LSU's season opener Saturday at the Cowboys Stadium venue as LSU faces TCU. All this, but now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, please call 877-217-5757. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Our guest is Congressman Stephen Joseph Scalise, member of the U.S. House of Representatives, Republican from Metairie, formerly with the Louisiana House. He was there for 12 years, three terms, and then moved to the Senate, succeeding Ken Hollis, was there for a few months, and then was elected to Congress, succeeding Bobby Jindal. And he has been a busy man, this graduate of Archbishop Rummel High School and LSU, and he is back in his old college stomping grounds today. Good morning to you, Congressman Scalise. Hey,
good morning, Jim. Good to be back in Baton Rouge.
Well, nice to see you, and it is a busy time on Capitol Hill. How's it working now? You've been there 5 years. Do you like your job?
It's an honor to represent the people of Southeast Louisiana. You know, a lot of volatility in Washington, and I think a lot of very challenging times for our country. And, you know, of course, we've got a lot of big battles when you talk about the deficit so massive, unemployment, the economy still is not humming the way it ought to be. And so, you know, there are a lot of big consequential issues that we still have to tackle. And, you know, and a president, I think that's going in a very different direction than the House of Representatives and the Senate are. So, you know, it creates a very divided government.
You were born in 1965. John McKithen was governor of Louisiana. I guess the U.S. senators at that time would have been Allen Ellender and Russell Long, all Democrats. Times have certainly changed in that regard in our state.
Absolutely. Been a big shift to a more conservative philosophy in Louisiana. And, you know, and I think when you look at how our state has moved, it reflects, you know, a desire for, I think, more fiscal conservatism. We've, I think, always been a socially conservative state. But, you know, now I think people are looking at issues differently than they did when Huey Long populism was still very much in effect in our state's history.
Who influenced you? Who made you want to get into politics?
You know, if you go back to my days at LSU when I really started getting an interest in politics and in how our government runs, Ronald Reagan was always a great inspiration. You know, somebody I thought was passionate about his conservative beliefs, but was able to convey that to the American people, was able to really articulate what conservatism meant and have a philosophy, but not just a set of beliefs, but a way to explain it to people that would, you know, basically could go either way, but because he was able to lay it out in a way where people saw how it would impact their lives and improve the direction of our country, Ronald Reagan was able to, I think, make so much history, not only internationally, winning the Cold War, changing the trajectory of world affairs, but also within America. We were coming off of the malaise of Jimmy Carter with, they had to create a new term, stagflation, because you had high unemployment, interest rates, and inflation. And our economy and our nation was in a delicate spot, and Ronald Reagan turned that around, too.
297-5633 for Congressman Steve Scalise, who will be at the Baton Rouge Press Club later today, speaking to media types from all over the state of Louisiana. Congressman Bill Cassidy, of course, is running for the U.S. Senate. Before we get to the decision by him to support what you are supporting, the government shutdown over Obamacare, what do you think about the Senate race next year?
I do think it's going to be close, and you look at the history of Mary Landrieu's races, every one of her races has been very close. I do think that the state has changed and has moved to more conservative since her last reelection. And, of course, Barack Obama was on the ballot as a new candidate, somebody who was kind of a, you know, an unanswered question in a lot of ways. But I think now our state's not real happy with the direction the country's going and not real happy with the policies of Barack Obama, from the president's health care law on down to his treatment of the energy industry to so many other areas. And so I think that I think Bill's running a good race. I think it's going to be a real interest in one, and it'll be one of the probably the most watched national races, because there might only be about five races in the country that will decide the leadership of the United States Senate, and Louisiana is going to be in the top three of any that you look at nationally.
You're a native of New Orleans, live in Metairie. That's the place that spawned your political career. I would think that Congressman Cassidy would be seeking your help, particularly in that area.
Yeah, he's been down a lot. I think he just had a town hall in Metairie about a week and a half ago, and he's getting good crowds. He's working real hard. So it's going to be another year before qualifying. So there's still a lot of time in this race. But in anything in Louisiana politics, it's a contact sport, and so he's already out there working hard.
Now you got to Congress shortly before he did. Some thought you might be running for this seat.
No, I really enjoy my time in the House. There are a lot of big battles that we're in the middle of. I just got elected chairman in January of the Republican Study Committee, which is the kind of the conservative branch of the House. We have 173 members of Congress that are RSC members, and we've been in the middle of a lot of the policy debates and kind of helping shape the policy. Not just opposing the liberal agenda of Barack Obama, but also working to move our leadership further to the right, where, you know, if we feel like Speaker Boehner's not headed in a direction where we would like to go, we work to move him further our way.
Well, Friday, Congressman Cassidy joined more than a third of House Republicans in urging the leadership to threaten to force the government shutdown unless Obamacare is defunded. Now, the letter that the congressman signed includes more than 80 of the House's 233 Republicans, and you were one of the first to sign, right?
Yes, and the letter itself does not call for a government shutdown. In fact, the only person really, I think, rooting for a government shutdown right now is Barack Obama, because he wants to make all of this debate about whether or not we shut the government down. And what we're saying is this is not about whether or not we should fund government. We absolutely have essential things that we should do. The Constitution lays out some of the basic functions, and of course, funding our military is right there at the top. But at the same time, the president's health care law is not only something that we strongly oppose. I voted against it when it came through. I was on the committee, Energy and Commerce, where it went through in 2009. And you could see the problems it was going to create in our economy when it was moving through Congress. Nancy Pelosi was speaker at the time and famously said, you have to pass the bill to find out what's in it. Well, we know what's in it now. And it's so bad that Barack Obama himself is actually agreeing it's unworkable and has started to say he wants to delay portions of it himself. Now, he said he wants to delay it for big businesses and for big insurance companies, but not for families, not for small businesses. And so what we're saying is, look, the bill itself is not workable. The law is a train wreck, as the Senate leader who passed it through the Senate said a few months ago. So why not delay it for everybody, since it's not ready for prime time? And that coincides with our budget cycle that'll end September 30th and start anew on October 1st.
Mm-hmm. Now, Senator Landrieu voted for the bill. Do you think this will be the biggest issue in the Senate race next year?
It'll definitely be one of the biggest issues. I'm sure there'll be a number of others. But the health care law, the more people find out about it, and there's a lot more that's still left to take effect. Many components don't take effect till January 1st of next year. And so as people find out more about it, surprisingly, more people don't like it. Even people that were on the fence that said, well, let's see what it looks like. There were a lot of lofty promises made by Barack Obama. He said it's going to lower health care costs. It's going to reduce the deficit. If you like the health care you have, you can keep it. All those promises have been broken, Jim. Every single one of them. It's mushrooming the deficit. It's actually increasing costs dramatically. In Louisiana alone, families are seeing about a 50-plus percent increase in their health insurance policies because of the president's health care law. So if it broke all those promises, if it's not workable to the point where the president said big businesses should get a year break, why shouldn't everybody get a year break since the thing is not ready to be implemented?
Were you satisfied with health care as it was prior
to
Obamacare?
No, and in fact, you know, if you looked at the problems in health care before Obamacare came along, The biggest problems were cost. Costs were too high and access was limited for some people. And so what I'm working on with a number of other members of Congress, especially within the RSC, is an alternative that actually addresses the real problems, because I strongly support repealing the healthcare law, not only defunding it, but actually repealing it, uprooting the whole thing. But you have to start over and then go fix the problems that were there before the president's law was passed, but that have actually been made worse. Costs were too high before Obamacare. They're even higher now. You know, the president talked about people with pre-existing conditions. I don't think anybody with a pre-existing condition should be discriminated against. We fixed that in our bill without the taxes and mandates in Obamacare, but even now Obamacare is acknowledging they're not even being able to take care of all the people with pre-existing conditions. We're able to do that in the bill that we're putting together. And again, it's an alternative to Obamacare, but it doesn't have these taxes and mandates that are making it very difficult for people who have good health care today to keep it.
Now, how are you going to repeal it with a Democratic majority in the Senate and a Democratic president?
Well, I do think public pressure continues to build against the law. And, you know, you would think a new entitlement that promises all these wonderful things to people, that it should be popular. And it was unpopular when it passed. It was one of the real reasons that Nancy Pelosi was fired in 2010 as Speaker, when there was a revolt across this country. But at the same time, the more people see about it, they don't like it. And so it's actually less popular today than it was when it passed. And there are even more bad things that are taking effect, including many of these taxes and these mandates that are causing people to lose the health care they like. So, you know, when the president mocks the votes we've taken, roughly 40 votes to either repeal all or parts of it or defund all or parts of it, there are seven of those repeal bills that Barack Obama himself signed into law. And he doesn't talk about that as much. So I think it's important to note that while the president says, oh, you know, that this thing's here to stay, you're going to have to deal with it, seven of the times that we've taken votes to repeal portions of the president's own health care law, he's actually signed them into law because public pressure has built so much against many of these components that people don't like about this unworkable law.
297-5633, your number, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Stephanie asks if you're supportive of Governor Jindal refusing the Medicaid money under Obamacare.
Absolutely. I think if you look at health care across the country, the most broken part of health care is Medicaid. And so when the president, through the health care law, said, you know, we're going to encourage states to expand their Medicaid roles, I think it's chilling the fact that the president would want to take people off of good health care they have today that they like and say, oh, don't worry, there's something free I'm going to give you. And, of course, the free thing they're offering to give them is Medicaid, which if you look today, and look, I had the head of the state medical society at one of my town halls a few weeks ago. We did town halls all throughout southeast Louisiana, record crowds. And the one we did at East Jefferson Hospital, the head of the state medical society talked about the fact that most doctors don't even take Medicaid today. So if you've got health care you like today, now you might be paying more than you want to pay for it, and I understand that. We ought to focus on lowering those costs. But if you have good health care, and let's say you're a family of four making $35,000, which in Louisiana you would qualify for the expanded Medicaid if the state went down that road, you have good health care, your kids are able to go see a doctor. If you're able to take that free Medicaid, you got the keys to a car that has no engine, because no doctor will see your kids. So now you're going to be forced to go to the emergency room if your kid gets sick in the middle of the night. And is that really a good answer to a problem? I think it actually makes it worse.
Ann downtown, Ann, you're on the air with Congressman Scalise. Hello, Ann.
Yes, good morning. Representative Scalise, I'd like to know what percentage of the districts that you represent are in poverty, and what have you done for them since you have been in office?
Well, Ann, if you look at poverty in Louisiana, we're actually beating the national average. But at the same time, you know, if somebody's in poverty today, we ought to be doing everything we can to work to help them get out of poverty. The best thing you can do is get a good economy. And that's one of the problems with President Obama that we've been fighting him on. You know, there are a number of bills we've passed out of the House. If you want to talk specifically about what have I done to try to help get the economy moving again so that people are not in poverty, the bills that we've passed to get the economy moving again, President Obama has fought us on every front. And I'll start with energy. I serve on the Energy and Commerce Committee. My goodness, LSU's done studies that say if we just open up more areas of the Outer Continental Shelf to expanded offshore exploration, we could create 1 million new jobs in America. Louisiana would benefit tremendously from those new jobs. Yet the president still says no to not only American energy independence, But look at the Keystone Pipeline, 25,000 jobs just there, and where we could create good American jobs, and the president with a pen could create them today, and he keeps saying no.
297-5633, back with Congressman Scalise after this 90-second timeout. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. Kevin Gallagher is producing. 297-5633 is your number. Inkster Show at WRKF.org if you'd like to reach us online. Melissa in Mid-City, you're on the air with Congressman Steve Scalise. Hi, Melissa.
Good morning, Jim. Good morning, Congressman Scalise. I'm calling with a question this morning about comprehensive immigration reform. As you all, I'm sure, both know, we have a system that is incredibly broken and outdated. We need some new laws that will help welcome immigrants into our country and also make our economy work better. And I was wondering, Congressman, what are you doing over in the House to support comprehensive immigration reform?
Well, thanks, Melissa. And I think you start with the premise, and I completely agree with you. Our current immigration system is badly broken. And, you know, when my great-grandparents came here from Italy, we had a functioning immigration system. And immigration's been one of the things that has made our country great. And we're also a nation of laws. And unfortunately, over years, through both Republican and Democrat administrations, the government has lost sight of the laws that are on the books and has stopped enforcing the laws to a point where now we have 11 million people or so here illegally. And I think if you go back to where the problems started from, it really will help you dictate how to fix them. And if you go back to 1986, which is the last time we've had a major rewrite of our immigration laws, there was immediate amnesty put in place in the bill, and then they promised later on, don't worry, we'll secure the border. Well, of course, they never secured the border, and so you've got a worse problem today. So I think what you'd look at is in the House, there are a number of bills that are moving through the House, and a lot of them I think are very good that I support. First thing that we need to do is secure the border, and the bills I support not only have the federal government put in place a system to secure the borders, but we also work with local law enforcement on the border, because if you want to secure the border, you go talk to the sheriffs in Arizona or New Mexico or Texas where you've got rampant violations of people coming across the border. You look at the high incidence of kidnappings, for example, in Arizona, which is a major threat to the people on the border in that state. Why should the federal government tell them they can't actually protect their own citizens along the border? And so we allow them to do that so that, you know, if the federal government's not doing its job, local law enforcement should be able to participate. You also need to fix your visa problem. And if you look at why a lot of people come to this country, they come, we want to encourage people to come to pursue the American dream, to come here to work. But if the system that allows them to work is so broken that they break the laws because they can't do that properly, you ought to fix that. So if somebody wants to come here and work, whether it's in the agriculture field or in the high-tech fields, those systems are so broken right now that literally we're training people in our schools. 60 to 70% of all engineers who graduate with a PhD in America are not American citizens. And our laws force them to leave the country to go compete against us when they could be getting good jobs. Mm-hmm. And we're literally turning down jobs in our country that you could have people making over $100,000 a year. So let's fix the immigration problems so that we can get to a functioning legal system again. And it starts with securing the border, and I support the bills that do that.
297-5633, if you'd like to call locally outside the area, 877-217-5757. Still time to get in with Congressman Steve Scalise. You may reach us by email, inkstershow@wrkf.org. Judy writes, my health care premium has increased in the 80s and the 90s before Obamacare. I am comfortable with requiring that insurance companies spend 80% of premiums on care, not just not administrative costs, salaries, marketing, et cetera. Your response to Judy?
You know, if you look at the costs, they've definitely been going up, but the problem is they're going up even higher now that the president's health care law is on the books, and it's because of a lot of the taxes and mandates that are in the law, but it also it's limiting the ability to have competition. And I think one of the problems with health care today is that there is no competition. In each state, you might have maybe 2 to 3 choices. And so, in essence, you've got many monopolies in every single state. You contrast that with car insurance, for example. You know, one of the things I support is allowing people a much easier path to buy insurance across state lines. If you find a better deal, you know, it's like the Geico commercial. You know, you see the little gecko, and he's saying, call the 800 number, and you could save 15, 20%. Well, if you call that 800 number and they quote you a better deal, you can get that insurance tomorrow. That's a Maryland company. You don't have that same ability in healthcare, and that's why you see costs going up so much. You'll get medical liability reform. I think most doctors will tell you probably about a third of all the tests they run on you have nothing to do with your health care. It has to do with the prevention of frivolous lawsuits. And so they run all these tests. It's inconvenient for us as patients, and yet they're doing this because they're getting sued all the time on frivolous junkets. And yet there was not a page in Obamacare that addressed that problem. We fixed that problem in our bill, and it's been scored by the impartial outside groups to save about $100 billion. That means $100 billion less you're paying to an insurance company, not to provide you health care, but to run a whole bunch of tests that have nothing to do with your care. It's to prevent frivolous lawsuits. Let's fix the real problems. They were made worse in the president's health care law.
Wade Adams writes, how long, Congressman, have Republicans been working on alternative health care laws, and how soon will we see details?
Well, there was an alternative when the president's health care law first came through the House. And you go back to 2009, again, when Nancy Pelosi was Speaker and they rammed the bill through. When it came through my committee, it was over 2,500 pages. And I've still got the original version. I'd be happy to, we'll have to take a picture and maybe tweet that out. There were so many flags in that bill of things that I had found and others had found that would be devastating for health care. But the bill, instead of shrinking and fixing those problems along the way, the bill got even bigger and worse. And in fact, the night before the vote on the House floor, Nancy Pelosi was in a room with who knows who writing the final version. I don't know if there's maybe two people in the whole House that voted for the bill that read it. And yet we did have an alternative that we put up on the floor that day in 2009 that would lower the cost. In fact, it was scored. The Congressional Budget Office is the referee in Congress. They scored that our bill would lower health care costs by 10%. And of course, under President Obama's health care law that passed, you're seeing costs going up more than double digits. So it would have been the opposite effect of what you're seeing today. The bill I'm working on in the House with the Republican Study Committee that we're putting together, it's about a little over 200 pages. We're going to reintroduce it when we get back after the August recess. But it's being put together by medical experts. There are medical doctors that serve in Congress. Phil Rowe, a doctor from Tennessee who represents parts of Tennessee, is the leader of the caucus I put together to write this bill. So, you know, anybody who knows healthcare, the doctor and the patient relationship should be preserved. And in Obamacare, it's you literally have the IRS and all these other federal agencies coming in between you and your doctor.
Colleen writes, beginning in January of next year, Medicaid eligibility limits will be increased so that adults earning up to 138% of the federal poverty level will be eligible for a single person. That's an annual income of $15,856. Medicaid expansion does not take people off insurance they like and mandate them to a state program. That's from Colleen.
Well, if you're currently in a healthcare plan you like, Colleen, and somebody that's at the current and under the current Medicare levels, if you have not expanded Medicaid, a lot of the people that have healthcare today are in that category, and they're getting private health insurance. And again, you might be paying too much for it. I wouldn't disagree with that. But I would say let's work on what we can do to lower those costs. But if you're getting good healthcare today and you like that healthcare from your employer, if you're making $15,000, if you're dumped into Medicaid, which mm-hmm. would be part of the Medicaid expansion, again, Louisiana did not participate in this, and I'm glad they didn't, because what happens is somebody who has good health care today is going to be dumped into Medicaid where they cannot see a doctor. Again, go in the phone book and start calling doctors. Just go down the list alphabetically and ask them, are you taking Medicaid patients today? And you're going to be hearing no from a whole lot of people. Call your own doctor. If you have a doctor today, 85% of the people in this country have good health care they like. That means 15%, we ought to fix the problem for those 15%. But for the 85%, you shouldn't break what's working. And if you're in that 85%, you have good health care, call your doctor and say, hey, you know, I have good health care today. I might be on Medicaid. Do you take Medicaid patients? More than likely, 90% of the time, your doctor is going to say, no, I'm not taking Medicaid, which means now, Colleen, you're forced to go to the emergency room to get health care because no doctor will see you. How do you call that good health care?
These people who would be covered under the Medicaid plan, though, they're not rich people, though, Congressman.
Well, if you're rich or middle class or low income, the bottom line is you won't have access to a doctor. When you're sick or your kid's sick, you want to make sure that you can pick up the phone and you can go see a doctor at that point. Now, if you're on Medicaid, you got free health care, so that might sound good, but you can't get access to a doctor. So you're going to be stuck in an emergency room for 5-6 hours or longer in many of our parishes throughout Louisiana. You go and you're maybe waiting half a day in an emergency room just to get basic care. So is that good health care? I think most people would say that's probably the most broken part of all of healthcare is Medicaid. Why would you want to dump millions more Americans into that system?
Richard in Lafayette. Richard, you're on the air with Congressman Steve Scalise.
Yes, hi, good morning. I'd like to say, first of all, I'm a financial professional, and I've been in business for quite a few years. And for the 20 years I've been in business, the health care has gone up between 12 to 15% per year, for 20 years as an employer. And most employers have been cutting back on that for at least that amount of time, and it was accelerating. Now, the reason I bring that up is because you said that we need to lower the cost. Well, we've been saying that for 30 years, and it's never happened. So my question is this. Why, under the Bush administration, with 8 years as a Republican conservative administration and a Republican and conservative Congress, that not one issue, it was never addressed for those 8 years. Nothing was done. Zero, zip, nada.
Well, first two of those years, Nancy Pelosi was Speaker, so you did not have a conservative group in Congress. Now, I will say this, you know, and there's a lot of blame to go around. I came in 2008 when Nancy Pelosi was the Speaker, but Republicans and Democrats alike didn't solve the problem. But the problem always was costs were too high, just as you mentioned, Richard, with costs going up maybe 10, 15% each year. What we're seeing now under Obamacare, again, just look at the numbers for Louisiana. Louisiana alone is going to be facing 53% increases for families that are buying health care through Obamacare. Now, if you think 10% increase is bad per year, which I think is bad, 50% is much, much worse. And so the problem was cost being too high. The solution was not making costs go even higher. We ought to fix the problems. Republicans and Democrats alike can be blamed for that. But you don't solve the problem by making it worse. You actually increase competition. You get rid of some of these frivolous lawsuits, you address that problem, you will start bringing the cost down dramatically. And we ought to all be working together, Republicans and Democrats, to lower costs. But the solution should not have been a partisan bill. Again, Obamacare, not one Republican. They deliberately worked in a way where no Republicans supported it. And so they went with this one-size-fits-all approach where government's in charge of so many of these decisions that used to be made by patients and doctors.
Now, under President Bush, the previous president, he supported and enacted a major increase for prescription drug coverage for people on Medicare. Was that a good thing?
Well, you know, if you look at that, you know, and if it came through today, I think, you know, you'd have to look at it to see if it's something that that makes sense for today's health care. But, I mean, you had a very heated debate in Congress, but ultimately George Bush worked with Republicans and Democrats. There was some bipartisan support for that plan. Barack Obama made it clear at the very beginning he was going to do this whether he was able to work with Republicans or not, and he deliberately avoided working with Republicans. In fact, he made speeches a number of times when he was moving Obamacare through Congress saying, if there's any Republican who's got an idea, I'll sit down and meet with them. Well, that day, I wrote a letter to the White House saying, I've got a list of ideas that'll lower health care costs. And it turned out me and about eight other members of Congress, including a number of doctors, wrote that same letter. Not one time did we get a call back from the White House to meet. We called back multiple times saying, look, the president's continuing to say this out there in the public that he'll meet with anybody, yet he's refusing to meet with us. And they never once set up a meeting with the president. So clearly the president didn't want to work with Republicans, and we see the result of it. It's bad policy. We ought to be focusing on fixing the problems in health care. You know, you can blame parties going back to the 1960s. And again, there's a lot of blame to go around. But do we fix the problem or do you make it worse? Unfortunately, Obamacare made it worse.
Bill Bryan notes that he likes the fact that the Obama administration has, in his words, issued the most deep water oil drilling permits for the Gulf of Mexico since 2007 as high crude prices revive exploration. The president's not totally against the oil and gas industry, is he?
Well, of course, he did put a moratorium in place right after the Deepwater Horizon that even his own scientists and engineers, the experts that he put together to figure out what went wrong, he went against what they had recommended and put a moratorium in place that we're just recovering from 3 years later. But if you look at his drilling plan over the course of the last year and a half, Each couple of years, presidents put out a five-year drilling plan. When Barack Obama issued his last year, he closed off 80% of the lease areas that were getting ready to come on board for leasing. So if you look at production on federal land since Barack Obama's been in office, it's down about 30% down. Now, the president brags that production's never been higher. Of course, he says that while he's trying to shut production down, but on private lands, it's higher. But on federal lands where the Obama administration has control, actual production of oil is down about 30%. And I get those numbers from the president's own energy department. So, you know, he's continued through regulations and other areas to try to shut drilling down. And you look at it both in oil mm-hmm. and natural gas with the fracking attack. There's a war on coal where you literally cannot burn coal in America anymore because of the president's EPA regulations there. So, you know, if we want to have an energy strategy to reduce our dependence on Middle Eastern oil, we could do it tomorrow. Unfortunately, we've gone the other way under this administration.
Okay. Mark downtown says, according to the Congressional Budget Office, the percentage of the population with health insurance in the U.S. is 196 million people, 64% of the population, not 85%. Where do you get the 85%?
You know, when the president's health care law was going through, there were a lot of numbers being thrown around of, you know, 30 million people don't have health insurance. Those were the numbers the president was using. Ultimately, as we would expose, you know, kind of where some of those myths were, the number would get smaller. But at the end of the day, there are millions of Americans that don't have health insurance that would like to. Now, there are millions of Americans that don't have health insurance that could get it right now, that have it offered to them, that choose not to take it. Now, again, this is America. You're free to decide if you don't want to have health care. There was not before the individual mandate was put in place. And by the way, I think the individual mandate should have been ruled unconstitutional by the Supreme Court, but they called it a tax. But at the end of the day, there were millions of people that have full access to health care, whether they could pay it out of pocket, their employer offered it, they just chose not to get it. And so where we ought to be focusing our attention is the people that want health care but weren't able to get it. And I use the example of people with pre-existing conditions because that is a real problem in health care. The president brags that he fixed it, yet the solution he put in place was a pool of money that ran out literally the first week it was opened up. So there are people today with pre-existing conditions that still aren't getting the relief that they wanted that the president promised. We have a solution to fix it that would actually work, but again, the president wants to keep his one-size-fits-all approach and say, you know, it's my way or the highway. Ultimately, I think families across the country mm-hmm. say, look, get in a room, work together. It shouldn't be a partisan issue. If there's ways to solve these problems, let's go and get it done.
Do you think John Boehner's doing a good job?
I think he's got a big challenge as Speaker. I think he's, you know, if you look at his history, you know, he's somebody who's been in Congress over 20 years, and there's things I've supported in what he's done. There's some things that I've disagreed with as Speaker, but at the same time, you know, where we've had the ability, especially within the Republican Study Committee, to influence and move the Speaker further to the right, if you want to call it that, where I think more conservative policy is better for the country, but, you know, maybe he was working with Harry Reid or Barack Obama. I think you've seen successes when we said, look, let's put a conservative idea out there that actually solves the problem, not just some deal that Washington's going to cut that's bad for everybody. Ultimately, I think the Speaker on a few different fronts has worked with us to do that, and it's not only been good for him as Speaker, it's been good for the country, because even when Barack Obama's threatened vetoes on some of the bills we've passed that were called conservative, ultimately Barack Obama signed some of those into law because it was good policy for the country.
297-5633 is your number. Outside the area, 877-217-5757. Inkster Show at WRKF.org. We'll spend a few more minutes with Congressman Scalise, and we'll also talk some LSU football when we return in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. 297-5633 is your number. Congressman Steve Scalise with us for a bit longer. And back to the immigration issue, I was in Washington last week, and there are some Republicans I spoke with who are concerned about how this issue is affecting the GOP, particularly in national elections. The demographics are such that unless the Republican Party, in their view, adjusts on immigration, it will be difficult to win a presidential race in the near term. Your thoughts?
we ought not be worried about political consequences when we're solving these problems. And you look at immigration, you know, and I do think if you look at what the president's rhetoric is, it's very hypercharged to try to divide the country. He's been unfortunately very successful at dividing our country on a lot of issues, but immigration's one. And I think you've got to look at the sincerity of what the president's talking about when he tries to make this a divisive issue. Barack Obama, in his first 2 years as president, had super majorities in the House and in the Senate. He could do anything he wanted, and in fact did. He ran through the stimulus bill. He did a bailout of the auto companies. He did the health care law. He did not do immigration reform. He left it completely off the table. And so when the president comes out saying, you know, these Republicans don't want to fix immigration, the president could have done anything he wanted on immigration. What we ought to be focused on is fixing the real problems. And that's why if you look at the bills we're taking up in the House, we're focused on addressing the problems with the border that's not secure. How do we secure the border? You start there. Then you go to the visa issues. 40% roughly from the numbers you hear, 40% of the people here illegally are not people who crossed the border illegally. It's people who came in on student visas legally and then overstayed the visas, and we don't follow up. We ought to fix that. There are millions of people who want to just come here to work and then go back home. We don't have a functioning visa work program that allows people to do that. So if you really want to tackle the problems, and I meet with immigrant groups in my district and also some national immigration groups that want to fix the real problems, and they'll tell you this too. It's not about giving blanket amnesty to people. You know, maybe Chuck Schumer wants everybody to get amnesty because he thinks they'll all vote a certain way. That is not what we should be doing when we approach this issue. We ought to be solving the problems to get a functioning immigration system again.
Dan downtown. Dan, you're on the air with Congressman Steve Scalise. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Congressman, you mentioned trying to keep federal bureaucrats from being getting in between a patient and his doctor. Would that not be preferable to the profit-seeking insurance industry and their lobbyists having a say-so as to the nature and extent of treatment for the patient?
Well, if you look at what the president did just 2 weeks ago, he literally gave a gift to the big insurance companies. And I know he loves publicly railing against insurance companies, and it might sound good from a populist perspective, but then you look at the actual policy, what he does behind closed doors, and just 2 weeks ago, he secretly gave a waiver to the big insurance companies on this high-end limit. And so if you look at why a lot of people have frustration with insurance companies, including myself, but also including a lot of doctors, it's because you don't have competition. You pick any industry, and if I tell you in that industry you're going to have 2 to 3 places you can go to get your services, chances are you're going to be paying too much, and you're probably not going to get the kind of service you'd like. If you change the game here, if you actually invoke real competition in the insurance marketplace, not only will you have better options for your family, Dan, but you'll actually be able to lower the cost dramatically because, you know, if I can pick up the phone and literally call that company in Maryland or call that company in Texas and I can get a better deal for my family and I cannot do it today, that's going to change the game. And, you know, whether they're making big profits or little profits, the bottom line is you want to be paying the least amount for good health care, and you're paying too much right now. You don't fix that problem by giving another gift to the insurance companies, which Barack Obama did 2 weeks ago. You do it by putting real competition in place. So now that person doesn't have that monopoly where he's only got 2 or 3 choices in Louisiana. You've got, let's say, 500 choices. That will lower the cost dramatically. And, you know, the people that are not giving you good service, they're going to go out of business.
Okay. Couple of observations from John. He says the congressman is praising Speaker Boehner only when he goes it alone and doesn't compromise after earlier stating that we need compromise.
What I've said is you need to work together to get problems solved. The problem is compromise in Washington seems to be defined as you take the worst Republican ideas, you take the worst Democrat ideas, you put those in a bill and you pass it and call it a compromise. And it doesn't solve the problem. And so if you look at so many of our problems today, you go back to the big Wall Street bailout, which, by the way, right when I came into Congress, that was the first big issue we tackled. That was George Bush as president and his Treasury Secretary. I thought that was a bad deal. So you want to, you want to pick on parties. I'll pick on the Republican administration. I thought that was a bad deal, that big Wall Street bailout. I voted against it. And if you look today, it didn't solve the problem. Democrats and Republicans came together on a compromise to do that. But look at the result. You had about $1 trillion of taxpayer money going to bail out these big Wall Street companies. You didn't fix the mortgage-backed securities problem. You didn't fix the derivatives problem. And you stuck it to our local community banks who had nothing to do with the problem. So that's a Washington fix to a problem using the old standard of compromise. What I talk about is solving problems, putting people in a room and saying, look, if you've got a problem with border security, you don't get some big comprehensive 2,000-page bill that doesn't fix anything. You actually solve the problems on the border. Get your local sheriffs involved that are at the border that are telling you what needs to be done. You know, Steve Scalise in New Orleans shouldn't be telling the people in New Mexico how to solve their border problems when they know how to fix them. And right now, Washington is telling them they can't do it.
Okay. John says that the president, in his view, had no ability to compromise because Mitch McConnell, the Republican Senate leader, in 2008 said that the Republicans should block all Obama legislation. So what room did the president have to compromise?
Well, if you look in 2008, Barack Obama had 60 votes in the Senate, 60 Democrat votes. He didn't even need Mitch McConnell's vote or anybody else. And by the way, if you look in the Senate, any given day on a bad bill, you're going to find two or three Republicans that'll vote for any bad bill. And so, you know, when you look at what the president had his first 2 years, he had super majorities under any rules, including the Senate filibuster rules. He could break any cloture he wanted to, and he did. And he passed Obamacare. He passed the stimulus bill. He passed the big auto bailout. He didn't even attempt to take up immigration reform. He didn't attempt to fix some of these other problems. And in fact, if you look at his economic policies, are being implemented by a lot of radical bureaucrats. Just look at the EPA. The EPA is trying to shut down every job opportunity we've got in this country.
Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, you'll be our final caller for Congressman Scalise. Hi, Phil. Good morning.
Please, how many times have you voted against the Affordable Care Act? And please, I know, do you guys really take pride in obstructing legislation and being the do-nothing Congress? I think you've got the best record in history.
Look, I'll vote against the president's health care law every opportunity I get, and I'm also going to vote to replace it with real reforms that fix the problem. I mean, if you think the president's health care law is good policy, you know, you're in the minority in this country, you're in the minority in Louisiana, but you haven't even talked to your local doctor. Ask your doctor. When the head of the state medical society says this is a disaster for doctors because the federal government is intruding in the patient relationship with the doctor, the main enforcement arm of Obamacare is the IRS. Have you not seen the scandal where the IRS literally has been targeting Americans these last couple of years based on their political views? That should frighten anybody, no matter what their party affiliation. But now to know that the IRS is going to be able to collect your personal health data, I think that's riveting and scaring a lot of Americans when they look at the impacts and the fact that millions of people are losing the good health care they have. Why you would want to support a policy that's hurting good people? Families that have good health care today are losing it because of this law. We ought to all be working together. It shouldn't be a partisan issue, Republicans and Democrats alike. And by the way, when we bring bills to repeal Obamacare, not only does every Republican vote for it, we're getting double-digit numbers of Democrats voting to repeal it as well. And so I think you're seeing a broader coalition every month that goes by when people find out how devastating this is to families.
Are there any Democrats on Capitol Hill that you respect?
Absolutely, and I've worked with Democrats on a number of fronts. You just look down the river in New Orleans, my neighboring congressional district, Cedric Richmond, and I served in the State House, as you know, Jim, but we also serve in Congress, and we've worked together on a number of fronts to pass good legislation to solve problems, whether it's coastal restoration, where we're not able to get some of our coastal restoration projects moved. We were able to reset priorities in a funding bill to do that, a dredging in the Mississippi River, recently with flood insurance, where we felt FEMA was not implementing the flood insurance laws in a way that was fair to people of South Louisiana. We worked together to actually fix that problem, too, in the House. You know, the Senate needs to take their action, but in the House, we've actually passed those bills and those amendments, and that's Republicans and Democrats working together. You might not hear that a lot in the national media, but it really does happen. And look, if there's a good idea, whether it's a Republican or Democrat idea, I'll vote for it. There have been bills Barack Obama's brought forward that I've supported. There have been a lot that I've opposed because it's bad policy.
Now, you're not happy with this lawsuit by the Southeast Louisiana Flood Protection Authority East. Why not?
No, I think they're taking their focus away from flood protection. I was in the legislature when we reformed our levee boards after Katrina, and there was a huge public outcry. If you remember back in those months after Katrina, when we had a bill it was a constitutional amendment to redo our levee boards because they were more focused on politics and foolishness and not focusing on flood protection, and that helped lead to the devastating disaster in New Orleans. And so when that first bill failed, there were only about 35 of us out of 105 House members that voted for it. Well, immediately you had an upswell of public outcry. Mm-hmm. 50,000 people signed a petition, and we finally got it done. And so now I'm concerned that when you look at the contract that was signed by the levy board, if they choose tomorrow, or let's say they choose next year, that this was a bad idea, and they decide to drop the lawsuit, there are millions of dollars being racked up in attorney's fees right now that the levy district is responsible
now,
to pay.
John Barry on this show said that the lawyers agreed to pick up all the costs of the
That's not in
fees.
The contract. You know, if they would write that into the contract, let's see them
You'd
do
be okay
it.
With
they
it?
Have not signed that change in the contract. I read the contract, and I talked to John Barry about this. I have real concerns, and if you read the contract, and I asked John Barry, give me the amounts of money that's being racked up right now. The meter's running. Every day, these trial lawyers are racking up lots and lots of attorney's fees. We ought to know as a public how much is that they're running up every day. They haven't gotten us that information yet, but every day that they rack up those bills, and it's going to be in the millions, if they decide it's a bad idea, drop the lawsuit, now the levy district is going to be spending millions of dollars on trial lawyers' fees that were useless, as opposed to putting flood mm-hmm. protection in place on the ground. That's why we had this levy reform in the first place.
Well, Congressman, thank you. Good to visit with you. Good luck at the press club.
Thanks,
and,
appreciate it. Look forward to seeing you there,
see
Jim.
You on the trail.
And go Tigers.
His alma mater, Steve Scalise, LSU opening Saturday at Cowboys Stadium in suburban Dallas. Fighting Tigers against TCU in the season opener for Leslie Edwin Miles, his ninth season, 85-21 in eight seasons, best record ever for an LSU football coach. A couple of SEC titles and a BCS championship for Les Miles, but folks are somewhat unhappy with him in some quarters because he only went 10-3 last year. 10-3 is no longer a good season for the Fighting Tigers. Cody Worsham, the editor of Tiger Rag, is with us. Good morning, Cody.
Morning, Jim.
10-3. That used to be great stuff in Tiger Town, but now folks want it all.
Well, since LSU's average record over the last four seasons is about 11-2, I guess 10-3 is a subpar season. But you know, LSU has a good chance this season to improve on that, and it all starts on Saturday.
Well, LSU lost a whole lot of players to the NFL draft who went out early. And some of whom did not, but still were drafted. So how do they fill the gap?
A lot of newcomers, a lot of new faces, but equally talented, if not more talented. You know, last year, especially on the defensive side of the ball, LSU really tailed off toward the end of the season, gave up four straight games of 300 yards plus passing. And with all the newcomers coming in this season, I think we'll actually see the defense improve a little bit. Maybe not at the beginning of the season, but as the season goes on, I think you'll see a faster defense and a little bit more talent on that side of the ball.
Now, the offense has a new coordinator in Cam Cameron, the fellow who was fired by the Baltimore Ravens in the middle of their Super Bowl winning season. You've interviewed him. He's on the cover of the Tiger Rag preseason issue. What kind of a strategist is he?
He's a good strategist, and you know, I've been asked a lot by friends and family and readers what I thought Cam Cameron's impact would be on this offense, and I think the offense will be better, but I think there's a misconception that Cam Cameron is going to show up with a new playbook and sort of revolutionize the LSU offense. I don't think he's going to change a whole lot what they do in terms of scheme. I think they're going to do a lot of similar things. I just think they'll be better at what they do. I think he'll teach the game in a more nuanced way and lend some experience to some of his players so that they're executing what LSU does a little bit better than in years past, and I think that's going to be his biggest impact.
Now, if LSU is to improve on the 10-3 of last year, the person who quite likely will have to improve the most as a quarterback is Zach Mettenberger, who didn't have a bad season last year, but some thought he was going to be a world beater, and he was not. How is he looking?
He's looking sharp. He's healthy. There were some concerns about his back during the offseason, but he's been throwing the ball well in camp, and I think Zach's going to have a much better year this year because the pieces around him will be better. Last year he lost three of his starting offensive linemen before the LSU got to the sixth game of the season. That's just not a good recipe. This year he'll have a little bit better offensive line. He'll have some more talent at receiver. And of course, LSU's running attack will be as strong as always. So because the pieces around Zach will be better, I think he's going to have a much more productive season.
LSU has won 10 season openers in a row. That's the longest streak in school history. Les Miles has never lost a season opener at LSU. He was 1-3 in season openers at Oklahoma State, by the way. A tough opener against TCU in Texas at Cowboys Stadium. This will not be cream puff. It's a legitimate opponent.
It is. TCU finds themselves ranked in the preseason top 25. They had a disappointing 7-6 season last year, but really were dealt some bad blows in terms of injuries. And, of course, their starting quarterback was suspended just a couple games into the season for some off-the-field issues. So he's back. Their running back, who got injured last year, is also healthy. They have lost some starters on the defensive side of the football during camp. A lot of attrition on that side of the ball, but they're going to have a good offense. It's going to be a difficult game for LSU, but I think they're the better team.
Will we see Jeremy Hill Saturday?
I don't think we will. I think when Les Miles uses the term withholding, I think he's referring to the fact that Jeremy Hill won't play for the first couple of games. I don't know that there's a set schedule in mind, but I think definitely for the opener, you'll see Alfred Blue get the start. Kenny Hilliard will get some carries. And if a third running back features, I think it'll be Terrence McGee instead of Jeremy Hill.
What if the score is 21-21 with 2 minutes to go in the fourth quarter and he needs a running back?
Well, Alfred Blue's a good running back. Hopefully for less, he can count on Blue or even Hilliard. But I don't think Hill will play. I think that will be part of the punishment that Miles hasn't really come out and stated clearly.
All right, you heard it here first. Cody Worsham of Tiger Rag says Jeremy Hill will not play Saturday. We'll find out. We'll find out how the Tigers do, and we'll talk about it as well. But we'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. For Kevin Gallagher, I'm Jim Engster. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Engster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Engster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.